Ted Cruz, the natural-born citizen, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Constitution says only natural-born citizens can run for president. So does that mean you have to be born in the United States?
That is not borne out by the law as it stood in the late 18th century when the framers wrote those words into the Constitution.
I guess that's good news for Republican presidential hopeful Ted Cruz. Also, the director of the Oscar-nominated documentary Cartel Land on all the attention lavished on El Chapo.
I think it's a travesty because I think the real story here is the suffering of Mexican people.
Plus the backlash in France to a rabbi's suggestion that Jews stop wearing the kippah or skull cap to avoid becoming a target of violence.
The problem is not wearing the kippah, the problem is the violence.
That's all coming up today on The World. Thank you for being with us this Friday. Grammys and Oscars will get a taste of two nominees for each of those awards later on the show today. Both focus, in fact, on life south of the border. But first, let's start with this news from the White House today. We hear from Washington that President Obama's advisors are in the final stages of reviewing a Pentagon report to shut down the prison at Guantanamo in Cuba. For 7 years, Obama's been saying he wants to close it before he leaves office. And it looks like he's doing it in slow motion, but things now seem to be speeding up. Yesterday, the U.S. released 10 more prisoners, all Yemenis. They were sent to Oman, which agreed to take them in. Jason Leopold of Vice News told me about some of the men who were released. One of them is Fahad Ghazi.
He was one of the last juveniles captured and detained at Guantanamo. He was believed to be about 17 when he was captured and detained there. And he was accused of being an Islamic extremist who traveled to Afghanistan, you know, taking part in violent jihad. He went allegedly went to an al-Qaeda training camp. His attorneys at the Center for Constitutional Rights say that none of that is true. He was part of a documentary that the Center for Constitutional Rights released last year on his plight, one that featured his family called Waiting for Fahd. And there's another Guantanamo detainee who attracted global attention back in 2013. This detainee, his name is Samir Naji al-Hassan Mukbil. He wrote a very graphic op-ed in the New York Times called Gitmo is Killing Me, which raised awareness about the brutality of force feeding.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and it was a widely read column. In his op-ed, he noted the allegations against him, and one of those allegations from the military was that he served as Osama bin Laden's security detail. And what he said about that was that it was nonsense, like something out of American movies he used to watch. So he was he was someone that was protesting his indefinite detention.
So someone like Fahd Ghazi went into Guantanamo at the age of 17. How old is he now?
Now he's 31.
So what kind of world is he going to encounter when he gets to Oman? What's his life going to be like?
Well, first of all, you know, Oman, unlike some of the other countries where the U.S. has transferred Guantanamo detainees, I mean, it's a country that is very close to Yemen. It will be easy for his family to visit him. There's, you know, it's an Arab population there, so he'll the detainees who have been transferred to Oman have felt very comfortable in Oman in being there. Versus Uruguay, for example, or Kazakhstan, where some of these detainees have been transferred, where they truly feel like foreigners. In Oman, it would be acclimating to life there would be far easier for some of these detainees.
What does Oman get out of this? How much do we know about the details of the deal that was struck?
It's very interesting. You know, I have for years have been trying to gain access to documents within the State Department about the arrangements, the diplomatic agreements, the memorandums of understanding between the U.S. and these other countries, foreign governments, about what exactly they do get out of it. And these are some of the most sensitive and secret documents that exists within the government right now. They will not release anything. I actually have a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the State Department to try and get that material. We don't know. I mean, you know, one thing that we have heard is that they get money, several hundred million dollars from the U.S., but neither the envoys, you know, nor administration officials would discuss those diplomatic agreements.
Jason Leopold there with Vice News. Obama just renewed his promise to close the Guantanamo prison at his final State of the Union address this past week. But can he finally do it? David Fracht is an attorney and also a reserve officer in the U.S. Air Force. As a JAG, he has defended Guantanamo detainees. So, Colonel Fracht, where are we at in the closure process at Guantanamo? How many detainees are actually left there?
Well, there's currently 93 detainees remaining at Guantanamo, and those fall into three categories. There's 10 that are facing criminal charges. They're at some point in the process of a military commission trial. There are 34 who were cleared for release back in 2009 that are still awaiting transfer. And then there are 49 who are in a category of very dangerous, too dangerous to release, pose a national security threat. And those are the biggest stumbling block to closing Guantanamo because there's no place we can currently transfer them. I mean, one possibility would be to transfer them to detention in another country. But I am not aware of any country that's offering to take them or certainly that many off of our hands.
And those very dangerous detainees, though, won't the opponents of closure just say, well, see, we can't let these people out in the world?
Yes. I mean, Guantanamo has become a political football. It really has been for several years. And with opponents of closing Guantanamo arguing that Guantanamo is keeping us safe, and with those who favor closing Guantanamo arguing that having Guantanamo remain open continues to provide a fertile propaganda tool for recruiting additional terrorists.
What is the holdup with those 34 who are currently cleared for release?
Part of the holdup is that there is a restriction on transfer to Yemen, and that's where most of them are from. And part of it is that the Congress has put very elaborate procedures in place before the Secretary of Defense can transfer those. So although they haven't blocked transfer, they've made it difficult and slow for him to do that.
What do you know about the Cubans saying there will not be normalization of relations between the U.S. and Cuba until Gitmo is closed? Is that pressure on Obama?
It's some pressure, but, you know, things are improving in our relations with Cuba. This certainly is a stumbling block. We have stumbling blocks of our own with regard to treatment of political prisoners and human rights. So, you know, I think in order for progress to be made, both sides need to budge on these human rights issues.
Right. And as a JAG, you know what those issues are pretty clearly. Do you think Guantanamo should be closed?
Oh, absolutely. I've been a strong advocate of closure for a number of years. It's incredibly expensive. It's incredibly damaging to our reputation around the world. It's a huge obstacle to us in the war on terror, I believe. And it has a significant symbolic value, and although there may well be a need to detain certain very dangerous individuals, Guantanamo as a place to do that is just toxic and needs to be shut down.
So briefly then, can Mr. Obama meet that deadline of closing Guantanamo before he leaves office? It sounds like you're saying he can't.
I doubt it very much. I think especially in this presidential election year, he's not going to get the cooperation that he needs from Republicans to make it happen.
Defense attorney and JAG, David Fracht, speaking with us from Orlando. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The legacy of Guantanamo is something the next president will have to deal with in some way or another. But first, a candidate has to be elected. One thing that's just made that election a little puzzling is the issue of Ted Cruz and his birth in Canada. His Republican rival Donald Trump keeps saying that makes Cruz ineligible to be president. Some constitutional law scholars have been weighing in on it, and what's interesting is that they don't all agree on the answer. Michael Ramsey teaches constitutional law at the University of San Diego School of Law. Professor Ramsey, we've been told you're the man to settle this argument. So a simple yes or no. Does Ted Cruz fit the constitutional qualifications for being president of the U.S.?
Yes, he does. Although I will say the explanation is going to take more than a few words.
Okay. I don't know how many words, but try explaining it to us.
Well, I want to start with the proposition that you have to be born in the United States in order to be a natural-born citizen. And maybe just to be clear, the Constitution says you must be a natural-born citizen in order to be eligible to the presidency. That is not borne out by the law as it stood in the late 18th century when the framers wrote those words into the Constitution. English law, at least since 1677, did not require birth in England to be a natural-born subject. English law allowed for some people who were born abroad to be considered natural-born citizens based on the nationality of their parents. Similarly, the earliest U.S. law on this point, which was the 1790 Naturalization Act, that act specifically said that people born abroad, outside the United States, to U.S. citizen parents were, quote, natural-born citizens. So I think it is clear that you do not have to be born in the United States in order to be a natural-born citizen.
So what is the fuzziness with Ted Cruz's eligibility about, the fact that he was born in Canada to an American mother, but his father was Cuban?
What makes this a somewhat harder question is exactly what you just said, that his mother was a U.S. citizen, but his father was not. His father was a Cuban refugee who had fled the Castro Revolution and had come to the United States, so he was a U.S. resident. He was temporarily in Canada, but he was not a U.S. citizen. In the first place, it's clear that Ted Cruz is a citizen and was a citizen at birth. There is a statute that says that you are a citizen at birth if your mother was a citizen, and that statute is applicable to Senator Cruz. But the question is, can you claim natural-born citizenship from just your mother? And that's the question that's somewhat harder, I think. The reason it's harder is because at least was clear in English law in 1788, that is at the time that the Constitution was adopted, it is clear that English law required your father to be an English subject in order for you to be a natural-born subject if you were born abroad. Some people have argued on this basis that what the Constitution adopts is the rule that England had in place in 1788, and that rule would not allow Cruz to be eligible. But let me just say why I think, in the end, that Senator Cruz is eligible. In the 18th century, the English law of who could be a natural-born subject had moved around a lot. I told you what the law was in 1788, but before that, it had been different. Indeed, if you go further back in English history, you find that there was a period when you could get natural-born status from just your mother if you were born abroad. And Parliament passed a series of statutes that changed the definition throughout the 17th and 18th century. As a result, I think if you put yourself in the framers' position and you look at what natural-born meant, what it really meant was it allowed quite a bit of discretion to Parliament to decide what the exact contours of it were. And I think that's reflected in the 1790 Naturalization Act, where Congress did, in fact, have a definition of what natural-born meant. And it wasn't the same definition, the exact same definition, that existed in English law at the time. It was Congress's own definition. And so, as a result, I think that whatever the eligibility of Senator Cruz in 1790 was, his current eligibility is established by Congress having given him birthright citizenship by statute. And again, there's no debate that Congress did that, and that's Congress's decision to recognize him as a natural-born citizen. Just for the record, I was born in Germany to an American citizen mother and an American citizen father. So, in my opinion, I am eligible to be president.
All right. Michael Ramsey for president. Michael Ramsey teaches constitutional law at the University of San Diego School of Law. Thanks very much for your time, Professor Ramsey.
Thank you very much for having me.
And speaking of nationalities, the rapper Mos Def, now Yasiin Bey, won't be leaving on the next plane out of South Africa. He had entered the country on a U.S. passport, but he tried to leave South Africa yesterday with a so-called world passport and was stopped from getting on his flight. It's a passport of global citizenship, but it's not recognized. A utopian idea employed by Mos Def, stopped by legal realities. South African officials say he broke immigration laws and can't return for a year. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's awards season, so for the next few minutes, we're going to talk about a filmmaker and a group of musicians who've gotten nods for their work. Those Nicaraguan artists up in a moment. First, though, the documentary Cartel Land has been called unflinching because it takes us into the brutal and powerful world of drug cartels, you know, like El Chapo's Sinaloa cartel, but also an unprecedented look at how vigilante groups north and south of the U.S.-Mexico border are fighting back against them. Cartel Land got a nomination for a Best Documentary Oscar this week. Director Matthew Heineman joins me. Congratulations on this, Matthew.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
You embedded with a group of vigilantes to shoot the movie. What drew you to the vigilante side of the story? Why is that important?
You know, this issue of cartel violence is something that's been heavily covered in the media. And I was, you know, really fascinated by how this cartel violence was affecting everyday people. And then the response of everyday people rising up to fight back, especially on the Mexican side of the story, where I was embedded with the Otter Defensas, a group of civilians fighting back against the Knights Templar cartel in the Mexican state of Michoacan. You know, almost at every stage, I was sort of asking myself, what would I do? What would I do if my sister was raped by the cartel or my brother was found hanging from a bridge? You know, would I take up arms? Is that right? Is that just? You know, these are questions that plagued me, that drove me, and, you know, provoked me to keep going down there and down there and down there to try to get some answers.
You put yourself in some pretty toxic situations to make this film, but also there were some scenes of like torture, of psychological torture anyway. How did your sense of empathy for the cartels actually change? Because it's the autodefensas who kind of like rough these cartel guys up.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a war reporter. I've never, ever been in any situation like this before. But the film led me into some pretty dicey situations, shootouts between the vigilantes and the cartel, you know, meth labs in the dark desert night, places of torture, places I never could have ever imagined being in. When I started the film, I thought I was telling a very simple story, almost a sort of classic Western of good guys versus bad guys. And over time, the lines between good and evil became ever more blurry. And unfortunately, you know, without giving away the entire film, what we see happen is that those who are fighting against evil start to become evil. We see human nature take over. And the film was this sort of wild adventure in which I ended up with a story that I never could have dreamed of or imagined.
You put a lot of time and energy and love, it seems, into this film. I'm curious to know your thoughts on the Sean Penn interview with El Chapo.
I think the sad thing and the thing that, you know, bums me out is that it's gotten so much coverage. The arrest of Chapo, the subsequent escape of Chapo through an air-conditioned tunnel, you know, this Hollywood actor going to visit him on a mountaintop. The amount of media attention, I think, is a travesty, because I think the real story here is the suffering of the Mexican people. The real story here is the fact that 100,000 people have been killed since 2007. 25,000 plus people have been disappeared. The failure of a corrupt government to protect its people. You know, Americans' voracious appetite for drugs, which is fueling this war. These are the issues that we should be discussing. And I think, you know, the only thing that I think was really important, you know, Chapo said it himself, if I get arrested, if I die, none of this is going to change. You know, unfortunately, that cycle of violence, that cycle of drugs flowing northward, I don't see stopping anytime soon. You know, we see it quite vividly in cartel land. That's sort of why I think it's unfortunate that this sexy story that's catching headlines, but again, is not addressing the underlying deep issues at hand here. And I wish those would be discussed more, with the hope that one day, perhaps, this cycle of violence will stop.
Filmmaker Matthew Heineman, his documentary Cartel Land has just been nominated for an Academy Award. Thanks for speaking with us, Matthew.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Now let's talk about a band from Nicaragua who've been nominated for a Grammy. As we hear from Beto Arcos, the band is following in the family footsteps.
In the early 1980s, when the Sandinistas took power in Nicaragua, this was the music you'd hear on the radio. Carlos Mejía Godoy y los de Palacagüina. Carlos and his brother, Luis Enrique Mejía Godoy, were the leading voices of the Nueva Canción movement in Nicaragua during the Sandinista Revolution. And this is what's popular in Nicaragua today. That's the music of La Cuneta Son Machin, also known as La Cuneta. Three of the members are children of the Mejía Godoy clan. They started playing in 2009 on the sidewalk in front of lead singer Carlos Guillén's house. La Cuneta means the sidewalk. The band's new album is called Mondongo. It's named after a beef tripe stew, a popular dish for hangovers. Carlos Guillén says the title's a metaphor.
Metaphor of all the ingredients that we use in our music, because our music, it's a kind of a mixture between a lot of rhythms, rhythm from the United States, rhythm from Cuba, rhythm of our country, of our traditional popular music in Nicaragua.
Guillén says La Cuneta's songs may not be as overtly political as their parents' music, but the spirit is there.
As a child, I remember listening always the music of Carlos y Luis Enrique Mejía Goy and other kind of music related to this movement. So there is a big influence, not only as a musician, but as a ideological thinking about the social movements and the social revolutions in all Latin America.
Last year, when La Cuneta were getting ready to record a new album, they asked their father, Carlos Mejía Godoy, for advice.
They asked Carlos what they should do. They wanted to expand their sound, and he told them to go talk to Gregorio. And they called me, and they came to San Francisco, and we began working.
Greg Landau is a music producer in the San Francisco Bay Area. But back in the 80s, he lived in Nicaragua and played music with an uncle of La Cuneta.
What they liked is that I understood their roots, where they were coming from, and I was able to create a vision for where they wanted to go. And I think that was important to try to take the project of the 80s into this era.
We have that same influence that our parents had in always talking about what happens in Nicaragua. All our music, it's always talking about our culture and way of living.
That's Luis Mejía, La Cuneta's marimba player. He says the band often asks their parents to weigh in on their songs.
It's nice listening from them that what we do is like the new way of doing what they have done in the 70s and the 80s. So that's also like a green light to us, like a aprobado. They approve.
This is the first time that a band based in Nicaragua has been nominated for a Grammy. They'll find out whether they'll be taking one home in February. For The World, I'm Beto Arcos.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, we meet a Greek doctor who treats refugees on the island of Lesbos. She says she gets little support from European authorities, so it annoys her when the EU applauds her work and says bravo.
You close the borders, so what to do with bravo? I cannot do anything with bravo.
That story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We're going to talk about refugees on the move now, and in a bit, the story of one doctor who takes care of the sick ones. Turkey has become a major transit country for Syrians fleeing the war at home. Many of them are passing through on their way to Europe. But the European Union wants Turkey to stem the flow, and it has promised the Turks more than $3 billion in aid. It's not entirely clear what that money is for, but human rights groups say Turkey is now sending some Syrian refugees back to Syria. My colleague at the BBC, Mark Lewin, has been reporting on this from Turkey.
Well, Marco, bear in mind, first of all, that Turkey is the largest host of refugees in the world. It has over 2 million Syrians on its territory. So we need to make that point to start off with. But there are other Syrians who have suffered a rather less welcoming fate. Back in September, there were a couple of thousand Syrian refugees who were trying to cross Turkey's land border in Greece. We were there, and most of them were cleared away, but those deemed troublesome were rounded up by the Turkish authorities and taken to a detention center. Now, we then lost contact with them, but a couple of months later, some of them got back in touch with us, told us that they had been forcibly returned back to Syria. Now, that is a violation of international law, which bans states from deporting people back to a war zone. We went undercover into a detention center to record undercover. We met one of them who was still there in detention. He showed us a photograph of his leg, which was very heavily bruised, and he said that that was down to mistreatment by the guards. And he told us that all the others who had been detained with him had been deported back to Syria. We tracked down one of them who had made it back into Turkey, and he told us that they had been forced to sign voluntary return papers on the Turkey-Syria border under threat of being put into detention again, which said that they were returning voluntarily to Syria, and others told us the same. Amnesty International say their research has found that scores, possibly hundreds of Syrians, have been deported by the Turkish authorities into Syria. We approached the Turkish government for comment, Marco, and they told us that they vehemently denied the allegations, and they said that the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, interviews all returnees on the border to ensure that these people are returning voluntarily. But when we said that they were, that our research had shown that voluntary return papers were forcibly signed under duress, and that people did not want to return back to a war zone, the Turkish government had no further comment.
Did any of those Syrians who signed those papers actually go back into Syria? I mean, this is a war zone, and what news do we have of them, if any?
The man who we'd interviewed, who had made it back into Turkey, told us that some of those who were forcibly returned to Syria were subsequently arrested by armed groups in Syria and put in prison, and that they had lost contact with them. So they suffered a pretty disastrous fate. The Turkish government says that those who choose to go back to Syria may have criminal ties, but we saw absolutely no evidence at all of any criminal ties or criminal allegations against those who were detained and deported. They were simply people who refused to be sort of cleared away from the border by the Turkish authorities.
So allegations of abuse and beatings, the detention, sending Syrians back to the violence in Syria. Why is Turkey doing this?
Well, that's a good question. Turkey clearly has opened its doors to a vast number of Syrians, and it is very proud of that fact. It talks about its open door policy on a regular basis, the government here. But they don't quite know how to deal with those who are not willing to toe the line, not willing to simply kind of reside in refugee camps, not willing simply to kind of integrate here. So it's just an open question exactly why the alleged deportations are happening to certain individuals. The Turkish government is receiving will receive 3 billion euros from the European Union in order to try to stem the flow of refugees and migrants to the EU. But that money is contingent on improving conditions for refugees here in Turkey, allowing them access to healthcare and education and the like, not on deporting them back to a war zone. So the deportations are small in number compared to the 2 million Syrians who are here, but the fact that they're happening is a worrying development and, as I say, is a violation of international law.
My colleague with the BBC, Mark Lowen, in Istanbul. Thanks very much for your time, Mark.
Pleasure.
Here's another number for you. More than 500,000 people trying to get from Turkey to Europe last year landed in one place, the small Greek island of Lesbos. 500,000 people. And despite the colder weather, they're still arriving. One of the people who's tending to them is a doctor, a native of Lesbos herself. Jean Carstensen has her story.
So we wait.
I'm standing with Dr. Zoe Lavatitou outside a bus full of Syrian refugees. They've just been rescued by the Greek Coast Guard. The night before, 12 refugees drowned in high seas, but this group was lucky. The Coast Guard saved everyone. And Dr. Lavatitou checks them all. She starts with the children.
But if the children are laughing and it is okay, I will see the old man.
There are no injuries this time, but everyone is wet and cold, and the children, as usual, need special attention.
There are many children that they tell me I want to go home.
She can't tell the refugee kids where their new homes will be, so they play make-believe.
We play. Let's fix a home here. We don't like, we change, we put trees, we put flowers.
Lavatitou's jeans hang loose on her wiry frame. From behind, she could be an athletic woman of 40, but her weathered face shows that she's closer to 60. She spent her career in crisis medicine, working in places like Afghanistan and Haiti. But now the crisis is in her home, the Greek island of Lesbos. As the only doctor on the island authorized to go out on Coast Guard patrols, Lavatitou works nonstop even as she questions the nature of the help she can offer.
Sometimes I feel so guilty because we give hope, but it is a real hope.
And she often wonders, who is she really helping?
These people, the smugglers, who? But even if I help the smugglers, I have to do it.
Lavatatu knew from childhood that she wanted to be a doctor. She went on to work with Doctors Without Borders and the Hellenic Rescue Team, which she founded in 1998. Now, on Lesbos, she tends to the refugees, but also to the needs of the locals who are suffering their own economic crisis.
I keep a balance between the Greek population, the local population, that they have an economic crisis, so I have to give medicines, clothes, whatever they need, food, and we share it.
The island's healthcare system was strapped to begin with. The Coast Guard is underfunded as well, so Lavatatu helps equip the boats for search and rescue missions.
So I take care for everything, for the gloves, for the masks, to have inside food, for blankets.
She's furious at European politicians who praise the island for its compassionate response to the crisis, but then fail to deliver much aid.
If I hear the European Union to say, okay, bravo, volunteers, bravo, but bravo, you close the borders. So what to do with Bravo? I cannot do anything with Bravo. If we are one family and our name is European Union, we have to be a family.
I run into Lavatatu again on a chaotic night at the port of Molivos. The night before, a Norwegian boat rescued 62 people.
All children. And pregnant women from Somalia, from Eritrea, everybody good.
She's been working 24 hours straight. The port is swarming with people. Some refugees who were just rescued huddle on top of fishing nets. They're hoping their loved ones, still trapped in the sinking boat, will be as lucky.
I don't know. I cannot cry anymore. I cannot shout anymore. Just I am becoming crazy.
We hug briefly. Then she heads back to the Coast Guard boat to continue with the rescue.
Patesos!
A few days later, I meet Lavatatu at a cafe. Over 50 people drowned in that boat wreck, and corpses are washing up around the island. Her emotions are spent, but she draws on her war zone experience to deal with it.
If you feel bad, go back, prepare yourself, and again go on. This is the trick, the real training.
Now she's preparing for the long, cold winter when crossing the Aegean will become even more dangerous.
I am really afraid. The wind and the cold. And they are in the sea finished.
But no matter what comes, Zoe Lavatatu will be there, working.
For this, probably they gave me this name, because my name, Zoe, in Greek means life. So I have to fight for my name.
For the world, Jean Carstensen, Lesbos, Greece.
Jean's reporting was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. In France, there's a social media campaign that's gone viral this week. Hashtag tous avec une kippa. It means everyone with a kippa, or Jewish skullcap. The idea is to get as many people as possible, Jews and non-Jews, to wear the kippa, or yarmulke, in public. And it's a direct response to a Jewish leader in the city of Marseille who urged French Jews to stop wearing kippas in public so they wouldn't be targeted for violence. He made the call a day after a Jewish teacher in a kippa was attacked with a machete.
When the religious authority advised the people not to wear the kippa anymore, the news became really sad and really dark.
That's Sophie Taieb. She started the campaign with another French woman, Kerima Mendes. Sophie is Jewish. Kerima is not.
The problem is not wearing the kippa. The problem is the violence. But we wanted to do something funny. So we created something easy, like everybody can do it. It's just posting a selfie wearing a kippa, either you're Jew or not, and you share it with everybody on the web.
So what has been the response to your campaign to wear the kippa?
Okay, so I with Kerima, we launched the campaign Tuesday evening, just to see like how it would go. And we woke up the day after and our phones were like full of notifications. I think that some people started to follow us. And, you know, it's like snowball effect, like everybody wanted to participate because it's easy and it's funny. And we started to receive messages of non-Jewish people such as, where can I find a kippah? How can I wear a kippah? Is it respectful to wear a kippah if I'm not Jewish? And we started to be like a kippah hotline. And
I was going to ask you, where are the French finding all the kippahs? Because eventually you're going to run out.
So there is a, in a city in France, in Strasbourg, where you have a very big Jewish community, a rabbi gave kippah in the street to people. There is a video on the web where we see this rabbi giving kippah to the people. The great rabbi of France, Chaim Korsia, asked the supporter of Olympique de Marseille, which is a football team, to wear hats in the game that will happen this weekend, like for solidarity with the Jewish people.
You know, France puts a lot of emphasis on the idea of secularism, the notion that public life should not include overt signs of religion. The rabbi who requested that men stop wearing the kippah, I mean, why were people angry when he essentially was just underscoring the need for secularism in France?
I will explain something to you. I've been raised in France, and in France, as Jew, we know that we should not wear in public religious elements such as a kippah or a Magen David because the Jews...
A Star of David, yeah.
Yes, a Star of David, sorry, because the Jews are often victims of violence in the streets. So, when we go to the synagogue, the rabbis in general ask us not to be like too distinguishable in the streets, so we are not targets for the people. We know that already, and we've been raised like this. But when the religious authority gives it like a message, a general message for everybody, then it becomes more official. And then, you know, we are French, so we like contradictions. So if somebody tells us not to do it, of course we will want to do it. It's what we do, you know.
In schools, young Jewish men fall into the same category as Muslim women with hijab or Sikh boys with the turbans. You can't wear the yarmulke in class. I mean, it was all decided to be unacceptable in a classroom. Are you worried that by encouraging people now to wear the kippah, you're sending a weird mixed message about secular life in France?
It's just one selfie, one day. It's just a symbol. I'm not telling everybody to start wearing the kippah for the rest of their life. It was just to show that if somebody is a target because he's wearing a kippah, no, we are all wearing a kippah, so you're not a target anymore. It's nothing more than that.
So a year after the Charlie Hebdo attacks and the attack on the Jewish supermarket Hyper Kasher, do you think Jews in France feel safer?
I will tell you something. In France, Jewish people represent 1% of the population. And 51% of the racist violence are towards Jewish people. So we are often victims of violence, and the government is trying to protect us as much as possible. But the level of antisemitism is really high, and it's not going down. So the Jewish people need to protect themselves better and to be aware of the fact that they can be victims. And what happened in Hyper Kasher, it's not the first time that it happens. In 2012, Jewish kids were killed in a school in Toulouse. And we had also this Jewish boy, Ilan Halimi, 10 years ago, who was kidnapped, tortured, and killed because he was Jewish. So, unfortunately, we are used to it, and we need to protect ourselves.
Sophie Taieb, who helped launch the campaign to get all French wearing the yarmulke, hashtag tous avec une kippa, everyone with a kippa. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Sophie.
Thank you.
Just before the break, I want to update you on something we talked about on yesterday's show. The World Health Organization declaring that the Ebola outbreak in West Africa was finally over. But one of our guests, author David Quammen, had some words of caution on that.
We should expect another outbreak to occur eventually.
Okay, but we didn't expect it quite this soon, even though the WHO did say there would be flare-ups. Just today, it announced a new death from Ebola, a 22-year-old woman in Sierra Leone. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. A couple of events took place this past week, totally unrelated events, it seems. The first was at the annual meeting of the American Dialect Society. Every year, their members, linguists, lexicographers, those kinds of people, they vote for a word of the year. And this year's word, or rather the word of 2015, was they. Yep, that simple pronoun that's been around for a long time. plural pronoun, usually, but what's new about it in 2015 is that they has become the go-to singular pronoun to describe a person in a gender-neutral way. Even the Washington Post now allows it. That was the first event. The second event was the death of David Bowie. Taken together, those things got the world's Patrick Cox thinking. He's part of our team that produces the World in Words podcast.
I'm not one to grieve the passing of people I don't know, but I'm still grieving David Bowie's passing. And I think there's a connection, maybe a tenuous one, with that word they. For some reason, it was one of the first things that struck me after hearing the news. David Bowie, futurist that he was playing around with they many decades ago. Back in the early 70s, he declared he was gay, just about the same time that he announced that he and his wife were having a kid. He cross-dressed, or rather, he dressed to confuse people about his gender. Skin-tight onesies, glow-in-the-dark hair, shiny red boots. So, on Facebook, I posted this. Back in the last century, this multicolored vision of lycra and eyeshadow appeared on our dull TV sets in our brown living rooms. He gave many of us confused kids permission to experiment with gender and identity. Thank you, David Bowie, for pioneering they androgyny. Of course, it wasn't intended on Bowie's part, this they androgyny. He wasn't a crusader of ideas or political positions or anything like that. I think he just wanted to jolt people into thinking differently, jolt himself too, by assuming all of those different personas. Here he is in 1973.
I find that I'm a person who can take on the guises of different people that I meet. I can switch accents in seconds of meeting somebody and I can adopt their accent. I've always found that I collect. I'm a collector. And I've always just seemed to collect personalities, ideas. I have a hodgepodge philosophy, which really is very minimal.
Very minimal, very effective. And through all his guises and his love of accents and artifice, he stuck to that philosophy. And he kept singing about the same stuff, fear and alienation. I was going round and round. Hotel garage. Must have been touching close to 94. Oh, but I'm always crashing in the same car. I don't know if you heard the interview that Bowie did with Terry Gross in 2002. They replayed it on Fresh Air earlier this week. Well, that interview was good on the subject of the past, the Ziggy Stardust time and all of that. But there's another long, in-depth interview he did around about the same time. He was promoting a lesser-known album of his called Heathen. And in this interview, it's with the BBC, Bowie talks more about the present and the future. Here's a bit of it from where he talks about aging and writing.
There are occasions when I really don't want to write. It just seems that I have a physical need to do it. In fact, there's an instance of that on the song Heathen. I realised the words were literally tumbling out for it. I was very alone, very isolated, up in the studio one early, as is my wont, at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning. I was up in the studio on my own waiting for everybody else to get up. And I was kind of putting the day's work together, and this thing started appearing for me. I'd already written a melody that I very much liked, and the words started appearing out of nowhere, and I just couldn't control them. And I realised what it was that it was about, and I was in tears by the end of the thing. It was really, I'm not sure if it was... It was a traumatic moment for me, at least. Possibly it was an epiphany. I don't know. I have to go and look at Epiphany in the dictionary and see if it was an epiphany. I think it was a traumatic epiphany. Steal on the skyline. Sky made of glass. It's a man confronting the realization that life is a finite thing and that he can already feel it. life itself actually going from him, ebbing out of him, the weakening of age. And I didn't want to write that. You know, I didn't want to know that I do feel that. Who does? It's not the age itself, you know. I mean, age doesn't bother me. I really, so many of my heroes were older guys. It's the lack of years left that weighs far heavier on me than the age that I am. I feel pretty good, frankly. And I do what I've always wanted to do. I'm a writer. But yet it's having to let go of it all, you know. Even more so now, it's so much more poignant. There's such a for me, often there's such a cloud of melancholia about knowing I'm going to have to leave my daughter on her own at a, you know, I don't know what age that's going to be, thank God. But it just doubles me up in kind of grief.
So eerie to hear Bowie's voice on such things now. That, courtesy of the BBC and our own Patrick Cox, with a taste of this weekend's The World in Words podcast. If you want to hear more, check out pri.org/language. I often turn to the title track to David Bowie's 1973 Aladdin Sane, a wonderful and cheeky play on words, speaking of language. I listen to it after a long day or when I need to calm myself down. I know, crazy, because the song veers from dramatic piano statements to Bowie's epic voice to sheer chaos a couple of minutes later. But the pianist on the session, an avant-garde jazz player from New York, Mike Garson, eventually brought the song back to a poetic conclusion, kind of like Bowie's own life. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. We'll see you back here on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.